This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Liam Fox, and we'll get straight into it because undoubtedly the biggest story of the week has been the elections in Solomon Islands, the country's first in 5 years. The big question for outside observers is, will the pro-Chinese Manasseh Sogavare secure another term as Prime Minister? For Solomon Islanders, though, issues like healthcare, jobs and the economy were front of mind as they cast their votes. Officials say polling was peaceful across the country, and it could take more than a week before all ballots are tallied. Our reporter Evan Wasuka was on the ground speaking with voters excited to exercise their democratic rights.
When you go, you check him, this blue, and then blue, make sure you check him now, page blue, very important.
The sun had only just risen, but already polling booths had begun to fill. With the energy high, voters like Central Honiara local Adam were enthusiastic about casting their ballot.
There's a mood for change. We need a change in this country. Maybe we change the system, or maybe we change the members in the parliament. That's the change we looking for.
John Iroga began lining up at 5 a.m. for the chance to vote, saying he's doing it for his kids.
It's important because our future is not in our leaders. Some of us who have kids, it's the future of our kids we're worried about. We have to make the right decision in our voting.
300 candidates are contesting 50 seats in parliament, and another 900 are contesting provincial seats. Three wards declared winners quickly in Kukum, Anuta and Tirotonga wards.
We now have the first three declaration of winners for the joint election 2024. All three winners were unopposed, and all three are from the provincial wards and Honiara City Council ward.
As more results come in, the newly selected MPs will travel to Honiara to form coalitions and vote for the Prime Minister's position. Caretaker Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare is hoping to return for a second term. But he first has to overcome competition from three other candidates in his home seat in Choiseul Province. Across the day, voters like Eugene in Honiara voiced a similar theme.
It's important to vote because I want a new member of parliament and for him to help the country. It feels good to vote new.
In the lead-up to the election, Solomon Islands has faced a tumultuous 5 years with political riots, concerns about geopolitics, and the pandemic. This is the first election since Honiara switched diplomatic allegiance from Taipei to Beijing in 2019. It's a relationship Manasseh Sogavare has highlighted in his campaign as a selling point, and an issue that has seen John Amitau come out to vote for the first time.
5 minutes to four, and I just cast my vote. Yeah, feeling high. First time. I'm 55 years old, but it's my first time to cast a vote. And it's special because it's both for the National Parliament and the Honiara Town Council. So
he says he'll be keeping a close eye on who the next leader is and how they handle the relationship with China.
We have just done the switch. So really, really looking forward at who will come into power and see, we continue with the China thing, or we switch back to Taiwan, or we look for another whichever country of power that we wish to engage in Solomon Island. As recently, lately, we've seen China really pouring in the aids, and at the moment, I'm sure China is trying to influence in some way. But then I know that the security part of it, the Australia, New Zealand, even the US are coming in, you know, inside of security too, so I'm really looking at the security side of things.
And as the crowd swelled across the day, teams of international observers were on site to closely monitor. Logistically, it's a huge operation, with around 700,000 people in the country and 420,000 people registered to vote, spread out across hundreds of islands and atolls. Police from Australia, New Zealand and Papua New Guinea were on hand to assist local police in case of unrest. The Royal Solomon Islands Police Force commended the public on a peaceful turnout. Electoral CEO Jasper Anisi says polling day went according to plan.
So far, I would like to thank everyone for respecting each other's right. Our initial report shows that all polling was progressing as planned across the country. Our morning reports indicate that there was no significant incident.
While the morning saw a large and hurried turnout, by afternoon the crowds had dwindled before polls closed at 4 o'clock local time. And as the sun set, many voters, like Adam, returned home, satisfied with carrying out their democratic rights.
The exercise of democracy is very important to keep the strength and power of this country. Democracy is very important, so the voting is very important.
Honiara voter Adam ending that report from Evan Wasuka with production support from Jordan Fennell. Early results are starting to flow in the election, and one of the most significant so far is that prominent China critic and former Malaita Premier Daniel Swidani has regained his provincial seat. Mr. Swidani was ousted as Premier in a no-confidence vote last year after banning Chinese companies from operating in Malaita, the country's most heavily populated province. The man who replaced him as Premier, Martin Finney, has also been bundled out of Malaita's local parliament after losing his seat. Mr. Swidani says he will stand to become Premier once again when the position is contested in coming months. If successful, he says he will move to reinstate the Aoki communique and block Chinese companies from the province. Here he is talking to Sam Seke.
The people now spoken. They've been talk in terms of putting the papers into the box. That's the way they talk about how they like the leadership style of Mara government, where I myself once a year ago being the premier. So feel very honored, you know, because people still believe in the leadership. People still believe in what my government talked about.
So do you still intend to be premier again of Malaita province?
Seeing that I haven't finished my work as a premier, my plan, my development plan for Malaita, I will still contest the premiership this year for Malaita province.
If you become premier again, what are you planning to do this time around differently to the last time you were premier?
I think the most important thing is to get engaged people meaningfully with the resources they have. That's one. And the other thing is to keep on with the policy, the restorative economy that we believe in. People should engage in restoring culture, restoring the resources, restoring so many things that have been lost in times gone by. So I believe this is the way we will continue to develop and to look at conservation of our resources, for the people to engage meaningfully with their own resources.
Do you maintain your previous stance in as far as not allowing the Chinese Communist Party agents or companies to do business in Malaita?
Well, last time we have this Aoki communique, and that is a moratorium. It's a principal document by the people of Malaita province. And that is our stand. It's a belief that we want to give a little bit of space to the Malaitans who can do business here and give them the opportunity to engage with their own people in the province. And that is very important. So I will still maintain my stand.
Do you have any word to the people of West Baegu Fataleka or Malaita following your election?
First of all, I want to thank them, thank all of the people of West Baegu Fataleka are voting me back into the provincial seat of Ward 5. Secondly, I would call on the people of West Baegu Fataleka to stay calm, even if the results come about. I respect other people's view because their voice is their vote. So I would like to ask or urge the people of West Fataleka to respect each other in terms of what has been done in terms of elections. They need to respect each other.
Former Malaita Premier Daniel Swidani speaking to Sam Seke. To other news, and people living in some parts of the drought-stricken Federated States of Micronesia are surviving on just half a litre of water per person per day. One of the hardest hit areas is Yap State, which does have some reservoirs, but the population on the outer islands relies solely on rainwater. As Dubrovka Volodare reports, the FSM government is working with aid agencies to deliver emergency water supplies, but officials in worst-affected communities say they need more help.
Many residents in Yap State's outer islands have had to ration their drinking water for months.
The grass is crispy, they said. They are now down to about a few more days of water on one island, Falalop.
John Rumal is a community leader from Falalop Island on Ulithi Atoll, who's currently in Guam to organize more aid for his community.
It's alarming or disturbing or scary to me because Falalop being the larger one with a little bit more excess, you know, having the high school and the air terminal there. So if they're reporting that they're down to that much, then the rest of the more remote outer island within just the atoll is probably in dire need right now.
He says the last water delivery to his community was too small. The last drop was 360 liters for his community of 350 people.
They're getting creative on rationing from what I can hear. It's alarming. It's a little disturbing. Scary.
Mr. Rumal says it's unclear when the next water delivery will be. He says the water distribution is not always working, with some smaller islands receiving even less. He's concerned about the most vulnerable in his community.
The grandmothers who will not drink because there's very little water and it's going to go to their grandchild. Those are the members that I'm nervous about now. Elders and chiefs will start to prioritize their vulnerable members of their communities. And that's scary to me because they won't say anything. It's not cultural. We don't complain about food.
Water is being delivered in small plastic bottles, which will cause issues with rubbish disposal in the longer term. Mr. Rumal says it would be better if it came in large tanks, along with reverse osmosis machines. The area is in a state of emergency. Meanwhile, UNICEF's water specialist for the Northern Pacific, Jeffrey Ng, says the situation is critical in parts of Yap.
Now almost 90% of their rainwater tanks are empty, and the government has sent some water to the island to help the people in the outer island. But now the situation is getting worse once they reach the extreme. So even in the main island, people on the main island already start having problem to have access to water.
He says officials have been distributing water, but it might not be enough in some areas.
The last distribution, the government has provided like half a liter per person per day that is going to last them for 3 to 4 months. Of course, we all aware of that this number is still not sufficient because definitely people will need more than that.
Mr. Ng says UNICEF is planning to send some large water containers from Fiji. The U.S. Coast Guard is also sending help from Guam. While that is being managed, some residents have had to deal with diarrhea from drinking contaminated water. Others report respiratory issues. Mr. Rumal says potential food shortages are also a worry, with trees and food gardens getting drier by the day.
Banana is the first one to show signs of lack of water, right? And it's now kind of falling down.
Parts of Marshall Islands are also experiencing extremely dry conditions. Disaster management officials there have delivered drinking water and filters to affected communities. Weather forecaster Landon Adlett says some minor showers might give some relief to affected communities, but it won't be enough to help with the water shortages.
Currently, we are looking at the ongoing drought steadily worsening because we're just not seeing the rainfall across northern Yap State and the Federated States of Micronesia and the northern Marshall Islands. Yap State, that remains a hot spot with significant drought ongoing.
Fires are also a danger, with a few burning in Yap last week. Parts of Guam are also experiencing dry conditions, and Mr. Aidlett, who works with a local weather service, says there's also a fire danger there.
We're still here. We do have days with the red flag warnings, which means that there's extreme fire danger, and that's based on the ongoing dry conditions and the stronger gusty winds.
Palau is also monitoring a dry spell and has called on its people to conserve water. Major rain is forecast, but not until June for the worst affected areas.
Dubrovka Volodair reporting. Fiji's LGBTQI plus community is devastated by the possibility that a young trans woman who died last month at the Lautoka Hospital may have been the victim of a hate crime. Fiji police initially said 19-year-old Esther Rivato died from complications connected to an existing medical condition. But an associate has filed a police complaint alleging Miss Rivato went to hospital after being beaten up by a group of people in a neighbouring town. Ratu Eroni Dina from the Trans Affirmative Action Guild told our reporter Lide Mavono that it's not safe for gender diverse people in Fiji.
So it feels like one of our children has just been robbed of the opportunity to simply thrive and be gorgeous and be beautiful. 19 years old, Lide. And this child was literally taken away from us just for simply existing. This is not the first person from the LGBT community, from our community. And more specifically, this is not the first trans person that has died at the hands of someone who took things into their own hands and killed a trans person. They did not even know. So there was a lot of sadness, and then it was of course followed by a lot of anger. So I also can openly say that I am also scared as a trans identifying person myself, not only for myself. I'm scared for members of our community who are consistently and continuously exposed to these kinds of violations over and over again, and it continues to go unheard and unseen. I need not remind people of the cases that usually grow cold and take forever to solve, especially when it has to deal with somebody from our community. No one should ever have to fear for their safety or face violence simply for being who they are. And yet, the reality is, every time a trans diverse person, a vaxaleleo identifying person, wakes up every morning, unlike a straight person, they have to juggle and make compromises because they're concerned about their safety and security every time they step out of the door. Why are we normalizing that human beings have to make those compromises every morning just to be safe? If that's the country that we live in, it's sad that we continue to turn a blind eye and we're not making any investments into shifting these mindsets and changes, that we're living in a much more peaceful environment. No one should ever have to fear for the safety or face violence simply for being who they are. So it is incumbent upon all members of society, including the media and all of the authorities, to keep challenging harmful stereotypes. My message to the LGBTQI community, the trans community, the Vaxaleoleo community, is be safe. Do not go anywhere alone. We live in a country that is no longer safe for people like us.
That's Ratu Eroni Dina from the Trans Affirmative Action Guild. The ABC understands police have now put together a task force to investigate Miss Rivato's death following a public outcry. The Minister for Home Affairs, Pio Tikonduandua, told Lide Mavono there will be a thorough investigation.
I don't know what is the nature of the injuries that he sustained. No, they are continuing to conduct the assault investigation because that was what was complained about, that he was assaulted and as the cause of death.
Why has it taken the police this long to give us an update?
Okay, I really don't know, because all I've heard about this case was when it was in the papers, you see, because I inquired about it. All I know is I've told the commissioner that he should investigate the assault. Someone is kicking up something that makes references to the assault as the cause of death, so he needs to get to the bottom of it, as opposed to what the doctor wrote on the, and I'm not reporting.
Does it worry you that a part of our community feel that there is hate crime being perpetrated against them?
Guilty. No one must be subjected to any crime at all. Full stop. Hate, send you hate. No one deserves it. That's the bottom line. We must speak out against it, you know. I know they are, you know, I'm hearing what you are saying, but any crime is any crime. No one should really be prejudiced because of what kind of orientation they have. You know what I mean? One's right, every human right, is enshrined in the Constitution. If something like that has happened, then it has to be investigated, you know, be treated like any other case.
Would you be willing to sit with the members of the NGO Coalition on Human Rights to hear their concerns about the what they say is an increase in hate crimes?
I'm open to everybody. I'm concerned that is what they're thinking. I hope that it is not true, that because of his orientation, the police, you know, have kind of treated the case lesser than the consideration for any other kind of similar crime. But I don't think it is. The police are actually doing that. I don't think it is.
Fiji's Minister for Home Affairs, Pio Tikonduandua, speaking to Lide Mavono. And finally, the inaugural Anua Anua Pride Festival has begun in Cook Islands to mark the first anniversary of the decriminalisation of same-sex relationships in the country. Prior to the switch in April last year, convicted homosexuals could be jailed. One of the key figures in the drive to remove what was a very old law dating back to colonial times was Dean Kapi Tangata. The incoming president of Pride Cook Island says the legal victory was momentous for the country's gay community.
It is absolutely a complete dream come true, not only for those of the Rainbow family here in the Cook Islands, but also our Rainbow family members and our diaspora that reside in New Zealand, as well as in Australia and all throughout the Pacific. It means a lot, not only to us, but also to our friends and families, as well as our allies who supported us through this 12-year long journey. It means everything, and particularly considering the hot topic of the LGBTQIA+, as well as the rainbow community all throughout the world. You have legislations coming in from all over different countries, which not only discriminate, but also hinder even the advocacy for the issues that our community are facing. So this law change isn't just for us, it's for everybody and all throughout the Pacific as well. It's a beacon of hope for those who are still struggling just to be seen as equal before the law within their own country. It means everything to us.
Yeah, and as you said, 12 years to advocate for this. And I said in the intro there, Dean, homosexuality was actually punishable by up to 5 years in jail. Are you actually aware if there was anyone who had actually gone through that process?
No, nobody has actually gone through that process. And the reason for this is because this isn't a law that was made by us for us. This was a law that was inherited when we gained our own sovereignty from New Zealand. These are part of the colonial laws that just remained and nobody dared to change. So nobody was punished. Nobody was punished for homosexuality in the Cook Islands. But it goes to show the bigger picture of decolonization and the journey of decolonization that we have to embark on in order to take back our own identities.
And for most of our Pacific nations, this can seem very progressive, right, for a Pacific country like the Cook Islands. But that comes with a lot of, like you say, stigmas that the LGBTQ plus community. What are they still sort of facing then?
We are still facing some stigmatization. But in saying that, there is a whole lot of love and kindness and pure Pacific sense of community that we are experiencing, because at the end of the day, we were killing with kindness. We were showing our Pacific mana, our Pacific love, and regardless of what anybody said about us, we turned the other cheek and we continued to smile because we wanted to show those who were opposing us that we aren't this image of Satan's children and angels from hell as depicted in the Bible trying to convert all the good Christian people into following a sinful life. That's not who we were. We were still people. We are still people. And in one of our campaigns that we ran through mainstream media on the TV, we talked about good enough because we were good enough to be your nurses, good enough to be your doctors. We're good enough to be your referees, your umpires, your colleagues, your athletes. We're good enough to represent you on the regional and on the global stage. Why are we not good enough to have equal rights to everybody else?
The new president of Pride Cook Islands, Dean Kapitangata, and he was speaking to Aggie Tupou. And that's it from Pacific Review. This program was produced on the lands of the Bunurong and the Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm Liam Fox. Thanks for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.